I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Heidi Ewing. She's co-director of the documentary Detropia, which is opening tonight at the CCA here in Santa Fe. There's a special event tonight sponsored by the American Institute of Architects and introduced by the legendary architect Ed Masria. And then the regular run starts tomorrow, Friday. Welcome, Heidi, to the Radio Cafe.
Wow, thank you. That sounds like such a cool event. I wish I could be there.
I know, it really does. So let's talk about this documentary. It's about Detroit. It's a look from many perspectives at this place and the place that the city is in right now. How did you come to make this film? Do you have a special connection to Detroit?
Well, I have to be honest, there was a personal connection to the story because I was born and raised about 5 miles from the city limits of Detroit in the suburbs of Detroit. My parents lived there in the 60s and, like many people, fled to the suburbs after the riots. And so I grew up very close but yet very far away from Detroit City, visiting my grandma on the weekends. In high school, you know, getting in trouble and drinking Mad Dog 2020 in the cemeteries and things like that, but always living in the suburbs. So it was a personal connection. And the more of the connection would also be because my father had a business with his brothers. It was a manufacturing business. So some of the themes when it comes to industry were personal to me. But more than that, really, my co-director Rachel and I got to discussing what was happening in Detroit and the gravity of it and the dramatic nature of the downfall of this place and the continuing hollowing out of the population and the tax base, even as, you know, in the last few years. And so when we started to just knock some ideas around, we thought, well, let's go take our cameras there for a few days and see what we find. And after a few days of shooting, we were completely hooked, and we knew there was a story to be told in Detroit, an important story. We weren't sure exactly what. So really we went in on really a gut, part gut and part personal connection really led to Detropia.
So as you say in the movie, Detroit went from being the country's fastest growing city 80 years ago to being the fastest shrinking city today. That's a pretty quick arc for a kind of rise and fall. What happened?
You know, it is. I feel like Rome had a much longer dominance than Detroit.
I know.
So yes, it was actually a pretty short period of time, with major advances happening in a short period of time in terms of industrialization, and you know, this giant behemoth that was built in Detroit and in the entire Midwest for industry. You know, so many things happen. I think really you could chalk it up to, well, it's hard to chalk Detroit up to anything, so I shouldn't even say that, but a lot of short-term thinking, hubris, the idea that we were Teflon, that there could never be anyone as competitive as the big three automakers, ignoring the signs from Japan in the 80s, the rise of globalization and global competition, the refusal to make small cars, assuming that there wouldn't be enough profit to be gained by making them, losing that market share. That was part of the problem in Detroit. I think, you know, long-held problems, racial tensions that started even way before the riots that were left unresolved, left a city-suburb divide that is unlike any city-suburb divide I've ever seen in the country. That was not helpful to Detroit. And, you know, just there was some corrupt leadership along the way. There's so many things. But also the vast size of Detroit, which is something we talk about in the movie. You've got 139 square miles, and which is the size of basically New York, San Francisco, I think, and Boston all put into one with room left over. And you've got only 700,000 people left. So you've got a giant geographic landscape with no public transportation and very few people to fill it. And that makes solving the problems of Detroit from the perspective of the city, you know, fathers and mothers, it makes them very difficult to solve basic problems. So it really is such an array of things that happened to Detroit. I think it all comes down to a lot of short-term thinking by those who built the city.
So what are the neighborhoods like where people are leaving? I mean, a lot of people have left this city.
Well, it used to be 2 million people, and now it's 700,000. So it's really quite an exodus. And it has not bottomed out. The population has not stabilized yet. It might be heading in that direction now. And you've got some newcomers. You've got some young kids from the suburbs and also from other states that are coming to Detroit with hopes to, you know, pay very low rents and maybe have a you know, creative inspiration and work, you know, as an artist and things like that. There is definitely a new community popping up in Detroit, which I think is really interesting because I think that it's another sign of our economic situation in this country, that places like Detroit are suddenly attractive to kids who would have never moved there 5 years ago. You know, there's people coming out of college with, you know, they're educated but can't find employment, and they want to go to a place where they can either make a difference or they can have excitement and have an urban experience. So I think that partly because of the recession, you're seeing places like Detroit see this little influx of newcomers. So that is happening, but, you know, it'll never make up for the, you know, the million plus people that have deserted the city. And those people are probably never coming back. So really, Detroit has to figure out how to become a smaller functional place, because right now it's a massive dysfunctional place. And therein lies some of the real challenges of the city.
We're talking about the documentary Detropia. Now, there was an attempt, and you show a meeting in the film, an attempt to relocate people to more densely populated parts of the city. I mean, there are neighborhoods where most of the people have moved out, and the idea was then to turn vast swaths of the city into urban farmland, which I have to say from the outside sounded like a great idea.
Sounded like a good idea, right?
How did that work out?
Well, it's a lot of things in Detroit are as yet unresolved. I mean, that one idea was, this was an idea that was started to be floated a few years ago, which is to make Detroit into the largest food-producing urban farm in the country. And it does sound good on paper, and it sounds great at a cocktail party when people are talking about how to save Detroit, right? The problem is all those parcels of land that are empty are not all together. You'll have, you know, three empty parcels, and then you'll have a house. You'll have two houses and then six empty parcels. And some of that land belongs to the city, and some of that land belongs to those. It's still in the names of those who've left long ago, so it's illegal to take that land. So it is a real nightmare to make that a reality. And also on top of that, you've got, you know, a very short farming season. Let's be honest. People know where Michigan is. I grew up there, and I only remember winters, but there's like an eight-week summer. So there's you know, to make that a reality is would require some serious vision and urban planning, and there are people thinking about these things. But there have been popping up little small gardens, and people have really sort of taken to, you know, growing patches of food just in their own neighborhoods, which I think is great, and it's happening in a lot of cities in this country. But in terms of a large-scale urban farm, that is yet to be determined if that vision will ever become a reality. What has happened is there's this this man named John Hantz, who has bought, I have to find out how much, but it's several acres, if not 50 or 100 acres, and he's planted trees, like little saplings, and the idea is that they can harvest the wood in 10 years. It's sort of an experiment. It's happened just recently, and that could be an interesting use of the land. There's just so much of it. I mean, we were just talking with someone today. Detroit should really start brewing beer on a large scale. You know, it brews its own beer, but it's the kind of place where there's all these warehouses and all this space. So if you can think of industries that require huge amounts of equipment and space, Detroit's the place to go. So it's going to take some vision for people to bring new businesses to Detroit. And on top of that, the city's going to really have to figure out how to make itself safer, how to make the schools functional. There's some really systemic problems in Detroit that if they don't get fixed, it doesn't matter how many businesses show up. You have to have a city that's functional. And right now, it barely functional because there's just no money to pay for anything.
Who's surviving best in Detroit at this point?
People who have hustle, who have swag, who are creative and nimble are surviving the best in Detroit. And some of those people are in our film. Our film focuses on people who could leave Detroit and have chosen to stay. We don't really focus on those so much that that don't have any other options, although they are in the film. We have a voice of a chorus of people that maybe would leave if they could. But our main characters are those who've doubled down on Detroit, that have made a commitment because they feel that the city needs people like them, especially Mr. Tommy Stevens, who is probably the main character in the film. He is a former school teacher who owns the Raven Lounge, which is the last black-owned blues bar in Detroit, and he's the only business on the block for many, 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 many blocks. It's a busted-out place, and there's one bar, and he opens it Fridays and Saturday nights so people can listen to the blues. And people who go there are former auto workers. And just up the street, about 10 blocks away, is the General Motors Detroit Hamtramck plant that's producing the new Chevy Volt. And Mr. Stevens is hoping that if the Volt does well and they add shifts and they add workers, that also his bar will come back. And so it's an amazing story because it really shows the interconnectedness between maybe unsuspecting people and the auto industry, that continued reliance on auto and on manufacturing for people's livelihoods. And it shows how Detroit is still such a one-horse town, it's such a one-industry town, even though the auto industry, even if it completely, quote-unquote, comes back, will never need to employ as many people as it did back in the day. So, you know, the film really tries to show the relationship between regular people and these giant forces like the rise and fall of manufacturing in the country.
The subtext of the film, to me anyway, is a double-edged relationship that so many of us have to capitalism. People mm-hmm. people want it when it benefits them, and they resent
right?
And they resent it when it does what it always does, namely exploit the cheapest labor and then move on when
labor... Capitalism doesn't have a heart, my friend.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't have a heart or a soul. People have heart and soul, and capitalism does not. So it's really an interesting prism to look at capitalism through when you go to Detroit, because really capitalism brought the best and the worst of times in that city, and I really do mean the best and the worst of times. And people are grappling with those consequences of this heartless machine that always just goes for the bottom line. You know, shareholder wealth is king, not human beings having a middle-class wage.
Exactly. And it really makes you think that Detroit could easily be a portrait of the whole United States and the whole issue that we are having with China, which is offering essentially slave wages to its workers but employing them and taking U.S. jobs. I mean, that looks like a one-way street to many of us.
It looks like a one-way street. It doesn't have to be a one-way street because, you know, the union, the UAW, for example, cut their wages in half after the bailout. So all new employees are making, you know, about $14 instead of $28 as a starting wage. So they've taken their cuts and continue to take their cuts. So at some point, it's really having a serious conversation with some of these corporations and saying, look, we can't agree to make $3.52 an hour all in, which is what you're paying for the same job to be done in Mexico, or much less even in China. So there are ways the companies can make a profit if they hire American workers. The shipping costs are less. You know, there's a slowdown in the economy in China. Their wages are rising. There is a case to be made for at least stemming the flow and stopping the hemorrhaging of jobs overseas. But the corporations have to want to do this. They have to say, well, actually, we'd rather have a country where there's enough people to buy the products that they're making than ship every single job overseas. So really, without corporate America coming to the table and having a serious conversation about the future, we're all kind of shouting into the dark, because it's becoming a situation where people are just slipping from the middle class into the working poor, and they're not going to be able to even purchase the items that these corporations are making overseas. So
exactly.
I really think we're like on a collision course, and it requires a serious conversation between policymakers, the people, and the corporations. And that hasn't happened yet. Not really.
Not really. And as I was watching the film, I was thinking, you know, when auto workers' wages get so low that they become essentially the same as convenience store workers, then people will, you know, manufacturing companies will start to hire them back. What kind of a country is that we're living in?
It's really scary. I got to say, you know, and also, I mean, I think we were short-sighted in the 80s with, you know, we really opened things up to a point. We thought that we didn't need these low-skilled manufacturing jobs. We thought that something else would be coming around the corner that would replace this manual labor, and nothing came along that can employ as many unskilled or you know, uneducated or just high school educated workers. And so we're left with this huge gap, this vortex of unemployment. And where are these people going to work? What jobs? I mean, a service economy, which is what we're heading towards, doesn't pay the kind of wages that, that the middle class manufacturing jobs did. So we're left with the mathematics problem. It's just math, and our film is really the human face and the human story behind that math, you know, and that's what Dystopia kind of became.
We're talking about the documentary Dystopia. Now, we see throughout the movie the Detroit Opera and opera singing. Why
Isn't
them
that
in
cool?
particular? Yes, it's cool.
Oh, we love the opera at Loki Films. Hey, most people don't know that Detroit has an opera house. We thought it was going to be, you know, we'd like to remind people that Detroit still has major cultural institutions that are barely hanging on, but they're hanging on. You know, the city recently voted for a slight tax increase in order to help the Detroit Institute of Arts stay afloat. That happened very recently, and this is a place where people don't have disposable income, but yet they're so proud of these cultural institutions, and they want to keep them alive. And so, you know, we thought that we wanted to remind people of that. And also, you've got this, Detroit is such an operatic place. It's epic, it's tragic, it's dramatic, and so is opera. And I am an opera fan my whole life and grew up going to that opera house. So I definitely pushed the production a little bit towards that direction. We didn't really know how we were going to make it work. But hopefully in the end, you know, people feel that, that it's a nice through line in the film and unexpected, you know.
It is cool, and it gives the documentary a wonderful style. And I wanted to ask you about that. There's no narration. There's some text, but not too much. There's no soundtrack. You're not pushing the viewer of the film into the direction that you want them to go. You really have the people in places. I mean, obviously, it's beautifully crafted, and it's very consciously crafted, but you have the people in places speak for themselves. And I was wondering, what is that genre of documentary that you're working in? What are your inspirations?
Well, you know, we definitely are very comfortable in a cinema verite experience in more or less direct cinema. We're not purists, you know, we're not Frederick Wiseman or anything like that. But we really, this film especially has a lot of wordless sequences, but generally we let things unfold in front of the camera and we don't push or pursue a personal agenda. Obviously, it's directed, and we've made choices, and every single frame is a choice that we've made. We're telling a story that we experienced. But, you know, in terms of pushing policy or pointing the finger at one cause or at one solution, it seems facile. It seems naive. And we don't think the country's in the mood right now to for us all to pretend like there's a silver bullet, because had there been one, you know, President Obama or President Bush, or, you know, we can go back for years, would have found that silver bullet. These problems are a long, long time coming. And so for us, we wanted people to experience what it's like for survivors in Detroit, for people grappling with globalization, but with, you know, with heart, with soul, with human stories behind them. And so we found the characters that spoke to us the most, and we kind of just went along with them. We walked side by side with them, and that's really, really our style. Me personally, I mean, you know, my co-director might answer this differently. I'm really inspired by narratives. So more than anything else, you know, because you want people to forget that there's a camera there. You want people to be so engrossed in the story that they're not thinking about your process. And I find that the best narratives, you know, you suspend your disbelief and you jump in. The beauty of our films is they're all real, but you definitely don't want people to be thinking, how'd they get that? Or you don't want them to feel the presence too much of the director. And when you have sit-down interviews and lights and narration, you're always reminded that this is, you know, a constructed piece with an agenda. And we try to remove those elements so people just are having experience, their own experience. And when they leave the cinema or they turn the DVD off or whatever, they've come to their, they've had their own journey, and it belongs to them. and it doesn't belong to us as directors. And they can experience that with their friends and take away whatever they like. And there's a lot to take away in this film. And so that's basically our style, and it's definitely on display in Dystropia, probably more than our past films, because we really, it's a much more free-flowing kind of structure than we've done in the past.
How have people in Detroit responded to the film?
Well, we were really nervous to how Detroiters would respond. I'm not going to lie. We were, you know, Detroiters are tired, and, you know, they can be sensitive about the portrayals of their city, and, you know, they don't suffer fools really gladly. So, you know, we were nervous that they were, how they would respond to the film. But so far, overall, it's been about 80% extremely positive. I think people find it an affectionate portrait of the city and a real authentic look at the lives of so many, and they've pretty much embraced it. There's some people that would have preferred that we show a different side of Detroit, or focused more on the newcomers, or focused more on, you know, the Riverwalk, or some other. You can't really, you know, a film about a city is a film about a mission. You omit a lot of things to get to 85 minutes. But overall, people have been really proud of it, and I think that they find it thought-provoking and an honest portrait. So far, so good.
The film is called Dystropia. Documentarist Heidi Ewing is co-director, and it opens at the CCA tomorrow here in Santa Fe. But there's a special screening tonight at 7:30 with an introduction by Ed Masria with the American Institute of Architects. So we will see you at the CCA tonight. And Heidi Ewing, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been such a pleasure. Have a wonderful event, everyone.
We're going to take a little break. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe William J. Cobb. He's a novelist. His new book is called The Bird Saviors, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte, and I'm glad to be here.
So this is a novel set in southern Colorado, although it feels in many ways like a border town also. And it's gritty and rough, and it's got cattle rustlers and a pawn shop owner who's not a very nice man, and a Mormon preacher named Lord God. Interesting characters. Tell us about your inspirations for creating and developing these characters.
Well, I have a home in southern Colorado, west of Pueblo, and I drive back and forth between my house in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and Pueblo, and there's a beautiful, gaunt, and rugged landscape in between there, and that's where I really came up with the location for the novel. And in my area, we did have an FLDS, Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints community, and I would see the kids at the playground, and that kind of spawned the idea of the fundamentalist preacher, Mormon preacher, whose name is John Wesley Cole, but nicknamed Lord God by his daughter, who's very much under his thumb.
He's an interesting character because, on the one hand, he is such a patriarch and knows best and doesn't want to hear anybody else, but his love for his daughter transcends that and kind of changes him to make him do things that you really wouldn't expect. He's a nicer guy than you let on at first.
Well, I see him as a good man who has been warped by his experiences in war and simply by growing older and kind of being pushed towards the margins of society. But he very much loves his daughter. She has a child out of wedlock, and he's worried about her. So he's trying to marry her off to an older man because he knows he won't be around forever and thinks that this older man is a good person and who will provide and protect her. Although that is a very misguided assumption, and he comes to an understanding and a realization later that, of course, is the wrong thing to do.
Now, what are your, you can tell very much from reading the book that you are grounded in the place that you're writing about. What about your literary inspirations? Who are the fiction writers who you feel have influenced the way that you write?
Well, that's an easy question to answer in that there are two very good writers that come to mind immediately in this part of the country, and one of those is Cormac McCarthy, and I'm a huge Cormac McCarthy fan, whom, as I understand it, has a home in outside Santa Fe right now. Mm-hmm. And the other writer is the novelist Kent Harif, whose novels Eventide and Plainsong really touched me, and I think they're tremendous books. And he has a new book coming out in, I think, just early next year. And Kent has a home in Salida, Colorado, which is about 50 miles away, and I've come to know him. And both those writers are very much an inspiration to me.
Are there also film or cinematic inspirations that you draw on?
Well, the easy answer there is the Coen brothers, who adapted No Country for Old Men and have various films, and they did recently did the True Grit film that I believe was filmed in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. I love how they have complex plot lines that have kind of intersecting and interwoven actions and events and characters that usually come together at the end in a fiery conclusion. And, you know, that's something I would shoot for as well.
The theme of birds, I mean, the book is called The Bird Saviors, and the theme of birds runs through the book, from the man whose job it is to shoot crows to the bird-counting scientist, people getting bird flu. How did you come to and develop this whole bird theme? I mean, are you a birder yourself? Anything like that?
I'm very much a birder, and but part of it probably occurred during my previous novel, Goodnight Texas, and when my editor was working on the book, he asked me, what are all these birds doing in your novel? And in this one, I decided to make it even more obvious, and I see them not only as an actual natural representation of our world, but a metaphorical representation, and that Ruby Cole's interest in the birds and her intersection with the ornithologist Ward Costello in the novel is really the goodness of the story, and these two people trying to make a difference in the world. And then they have, you know, they're offset by people like the pawn shop owner, Hiram Page, who's kind of a small-town crime lord. And I think that gives a vision of the world that should be interesting.
They are such an interesting metaphor, and I've been thinking a lot about crows lately because we interviewed a fellow named Tony Angel who has a book called Gifts of the Crow, and it's a nonfiction book, but it's basically crows are so much more like us than anybody thought, and observation of birds leads you kind of toward different perceptions about human beings.
Absolutely. Crows are surprisingly intelligent, and ravens as well. There's a great book about ravens called The Mind of the Raven, and I forget the writer's name, but it was part of an inspiration for the novel as well, because the writer of that book is a field ornithologist, and he describes what ornithologists actually do in trying, say, to count birds or to observe bird behavior when it's sometimes very difficult. And I see Ruby as personifying the birds and giving them personality and, you know, kind of more the figurative element. And then the ornithologist is looking at it in a scientific way.
Now, do Southwesterners respond particularly to this book? Or has it been, I don't know if it's been out long enough for you to really be able to say that.
I can't say, because, of course, I'm not in touch with all different people. I would think that in some people from the East Coast would find it more exotic and, you know, out of the ordinary. and that people from the Southwest will recognize it as being more familiar. I did have one writer friend from New York City who read it and found it so very unusual and different. And, of course, that's a good thing as well. We always want to be unique. but all of the themes and the landscape, to me, seem very natural to this part of the world.
They do indeed, and I guess that's something, as somebody who is from the East Coast, but who I've lived here for so many years, I remember reading things from the West and the Southwest that seemed very exotic at one point and now seem like just normal daily life. It's funny. And I have a great fondness for Southwestern work because it's so familiar. It's really our people and places.
I do, too. Right now, it seems like all my favorite writers are writing about the West or located in the West. And that might be just my own, you know, bias and predilection. But to me, I think this is a happening part of the world.
What's next for you? Are you working on another book?
I am working on a novel right now with the tentative title, The Lost Person. And part of that's been put into, you know, an impetus for this novel is that I've joined Custer County Search and Rescue and have learned something about when a person is lost up in the mountains, you know, who the people are that go search for them. And I've been on missions and have learned something about that. And it's really fascinating. And there's a lot of drama to it and danger and excitement. And I think it should make for a good novel.
William Jacob is author of the new novel, The Bird Saviors. And once again, tonight at 6 o'clock, he will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. We look forward to seeing you.
Well, thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. And I hope people come out. I promise to do a great reading.
Okay, great. Good. We look forward to meeting you. And I'd like now to welcome back to the show Lucian Niemeyer. He is a photographer, and he has many books out, and a new show of his is opening this Saturday, October 6th, at La Tienda at El Dorado. It's called Africa, the Holocausts of Rwanda and Sudan. There's a reception from 5 to 7 on Saturday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
Now, we've talked about both of the books, the Africa books that you've done. One is the same name as the exhibition, Africa, the Holocaust of Rwanda and Sudan, and the other is Darfur. And you've spent quite a bit of time photographing in those places. How have things changed since you were last there, and above all, since you published these books?
Well, since that time, there's been a new country, South Sudan. It's the newest country in the world. And it was formed from the old Southern Sudan borders that were done before the British. The British came and they made it one. And at that time, they moved their administration from Juba to Khartoum. So the new lines are basically the same as was before the British molded the two countries together.
And so what is it actually like there in this new country, South Sudan?
Well, it's a new democracy, and it consists of three tribes, the Dinka, the Nuer, and the Shilluk. And there's no infrastructure. There is the capital is Juba. They're putting a few roads in now. It's Potpourri. There's buildings going up, but there is no real justice system. There's no banking system. There is no infrastructure as we would know in any country. Their main money or their main support comes from the oil that comes from the south and then runs to the north. And there's been a big conflict on that between the north and the south, and there was almost war again. But it's been resolved this last week, in which they've come to the agreement that South Sudan pumps the oil and it goes through the northern Sudan pipelines to the port of the Red Sea.
So when you have a so-called democracy without the infrastructure of a modern democracy, the way we think of it and expect it and things like that. What is it? What's really going on there?
Well, it's very difficult. You still have the tribal conflicts between the Nuer and the Dinka, the two largest tribes. And every once in a while, there will be a breakout. There's consistent struggles among the different tribes there. So it's very difficult to put together a country. There were no roads when I was there, no paved roads. Now there's some paved roads in Juba, but for all intents and purposes, there's still tracks across a large country.
Now, are these different tribes who are living there, are they self-sufficient? Do they produce their own water and food and clothing and so on?
Yes, usually. But as you remember in our discussions, the war, one of the strategies in the war was to move the tribe people away from their corn and their food and their water, and that created death. The problem is in southern Sudan, it's very arid, like New Mexico, and the time to sow food is in a very short time frame of maybe 2 or 3 weeks. If they don't sow it in the ground, they won't have food later. So there's been a lot of disruption of this, and it's going to take some years to even get it back to normal. The displacement was enormous, of people, and so it is a country at its very, very, very basic.
Now, are people going back, people who were displaced?
Yes, they're coming back, and that creates a problem on the food sources. As I said, if they miss that season to grow, it is incredible. When you go into a village, you will see a well. That is the infrastructure of the South. Then they might have a small medical aid center, and if they're lucky, they have a school. But beyond that, there is nothing.
Now, what about, I mean, I keep thinking these people have been surviving for longer than there has been democracy, at least on a large scale. They're for longer than there has been roads and banks and infrastructure. Those are relatively modern things, but you have here in the Southwest and in Africa and everywhere in the world, people who have actual traditional ways of life that are reasonably sustainable, that go back forever. Are those ways, I mean, can they be revitalized, or is that going to be a thing of the past?
Well, interestingly enough, they tell me that in the Nile area, in the overflow areas of the Nile, there is enough arable land to feed the whole world. It is incredibly rich that way. It is an old country, as you know. The beginnings of the man can be found in that area. So when you're talking about this, and I talk about this in the Darfur book, you're going back into 2,000, 3,000 years before Christ, as they built the pyramids and the people fled into the Sudan from the raids for slavery. And so it's a very old country. And then, of course, the conflict between the Arabs then conquered the northern part of all of Africa, Northern Horn. And so the conflicts then between the Arabs and the black that existed there for so many thousands of years is pretty sharp. It was erased when there's peace, but as soon as there is war and conflict, it is a great divide, and that's, of course, where we had the big genocides.
We're talking to photographer Lucian Niemeyer. So what is your role there now? When were you last there as a photographer, as a visitor?
I was there in 2002. I've had some contact in the last few days with the very high people in the Khartoum government. I don't know what they want from me, but I know that this book has had the Africa book has had an enormous impact in the government. Foundation gave a copy to every senator and also to people in the United Nations, and for some reason it's had a life of its own that has continued to ask me to be participating in.
That's fascinating. What has been the effect of your book? How have people responded to it?
Very, very favorably. The most of the response has come from people from the Sudan that have been displaced or have come to this country. They have said, we are so happy to see the true account of what has happened there. And I got to tell you a little story on that. I was before I was going to Darfur, I had to go to Uganda to get a visa to go into Sudan. And I was in a hotel there, and for some reason, the people in Sudan had heard that I was going to be there. They knew of the book. Eight of them traveled for 2 weeks, walking and by bus, to come to visit me. I was so embarrassed by it all. And they asked me for some books, and they got it, but they came to visit. The book has had power in a place where there is very, very little communication except word by word of mouth.
It's fascinating because, of course, photography has the ability to both tell it like it is and open people's hearts.
Well, that was the objective of my work, that if you look at my work, you'll see very close-up people who have overcome the problem, people who are suffering under the problem. It is a powerful, powerful story of the edge of humankind that the world does not hear enough about. We hear of problems, of course, in Mexico. We hear of problems in other parts of the world. But this is the frontier of humankind.
Now, are foreign aid organizations and charities who are concerned with the well-being of people in far-flung places, are they getting involved there?
Very much so. And I am so happy about that. If you notice in both of my books, I have dedicated to the non-governmental organizations who go in there at the threat of their lives, and they go in there to help. It is an amazing, amazing story what has happened from America, most of it, going into these countries and helping. It's striking. America is the largest supplier of food to Sudan, and has been very, very much involved with very little publicity to it.
There is a photograph of a young boy that your caption in the book says is a slave. What is the situation of slavery in modern-day Sudan?
It continues. When I did the book, the only people that were redeemed were the people that the owners wanted to get rid of, which were maybe the top bottom 25% of what is there. The slavery between the Muslim and the over the Dinka in the south continues, still on. And the CSI, which is involved in buying them back, is still working very hard to buy back as many of the slaves as they can. I don't know what the current price, but of course the price when I was there was $35 a slave to redeem them, and that was the price of a goat.
Good heavens. So you could go there with a pocket full of cash and save 10 or 20 people?
Precisely.
Did you do that?
Yes, we did. We did 4,100 people. And it's an amazing story, because what happens is you see the first all of the accounting going on, and then you see the documentation of the people that are redeemed, so they aren't redeemed again and again and again, and then all of a sudden they're let go, and they go to their villages, and some don't know where to go and what to go. It is a frontier of the human condition.
Have you been able to follow up with any of the people whose lives were liberated in that way?
No, I have not been able. You have to know that it's so difficult to communicate, so difficult to go anywhere to do anything. You go in by plane. You go into dirt landing strips that are very, very rough, and sometimes there are accidents happen there. There is no way to get in there. There's no ability to get in there. So the difficulties of following something like that, I've tried to, but it's impossible. I can't even get to the leaders.
We're talking to Lucian Niemeyer about his exhibit, Africa, the Holocaust of Rwanda and Sudan. Now, this exhibition, these photographs, which are very powerful, not only has the book had a real effect, as you just mentioned, but the exhibit has been shown in a bunch of places.
Yes, it was very lucky. It was shown the first time. One of the Rwanda story was told in Delaware Art Museum, which is a prestigious art museum, and I was very lucky to then, and then it went to Lehigh, and it's gone to many places, including St. John's. About 3 years ago, it had a whole year at the Maxwell Museum at the University of New Mexico, which is a very prestigious museum.
And this is a couple hundred photographs?
This is 160-some photographs and another 40 panels.
Wow.
And they did it for, they took each story in each quarter. They did the Rwanda story, then the slave story, and then the Nuba Mountain story, and the Holy Jihad story in each quarter. And Paul Rissanjani, the man from Rwanda, and I gave a lecture there. There was a lot of people that came in that were very familiar with that situation, including Sudanese.
Tell our listeners why you think it's important for Americans to know about this and to get involved.
Because it is a frontier of humankind. To understand what this world is about and the difficulties in it, if you see this exhibit and you see the people that are portrayed in it and what they face, it is extremely powerful. And it's far greater. You know, people said, well, weren't you afraid? No, you're not afraid. You're involved in such a big story that you're so small and you're not important. It's a huge story, and it's a story that if people see, they will forget the problems they have, because it's nothing compared to what you're seeing.
No doubt. I mean, there's one photograph of a woman who has flies on her face, beautiful, looking down, looking sad, and the flies connote disease.
Yes, it does. And she's going to die. It is a disease that produces sweetness to the skin. And life is very, very cheap there. You're talking maybe, you know, if you're 39 years old, you're old. There's a little story on that. I went into a village when we were redeeming slaves, and I asked who was the oldest man in the village, and they pointed him out, and he was a gray-haired man. And I walked up to him, and I had an interpreter, and I said, I understand you're the oldest man in the village. And he said, yes. I said, what year were you born? He said, 1942. And I said, I was born in 1937. He put his hand out, brother. But it is remarkable, because he was an old man, and life is very, very cheap there.
So the exhibit is called Africa, the Holocaust of Rwanda and Sudan, and it's at La Tienda at El Dorado, opening this Saturday, the 6th of October, from 5 to 7, and running for about 4 weeks through November 3rd. Now, how much of the whole exhibit are you going to have there?
The whole exhibit.
The whole thing's going to be there, so that's a big space.
It's big space, and it's up now.
Excellent. So people can wander over.
Yeah, they can sneak in.
They can wander over and sneak in. But the reception is on Saturday, and your books will also be available there.
Yes.
So any planned trips anytime soon?
I don't know. Somebody's always probing in and poking in, and I don't know. And yes, it'll probably be a trip, but you don't know. You're at the mercy. If they have a need, I'll go. If there's just a trip, I don't want to go. There has to be something of value for me to tell.
Photographer Lucian Niemeyer, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.